Sarah Penniman, and we're in, talking in her office, and this is July 6, 1981, and I'm Laura Smale. So we'll just, I'd like to ask you to begin with what in your family and your childhood led you into an academic career.
That's always a rather difficult question to answer with certainty. All I can say is that I came out of a family, well, neither of my parents had college degrees. They had some college background. But primarily they were interested in intellectual things in the sense that they enjoyed reading. They encouraged reading on our part. They read to us until we were able to read by ourselves. And even then, there was sometimes family reading. My mother had taught history in grade school, and she used to tell us stories, really almost bedtime stories. And as I think I said one time, I recall crying over Benedict Arnold. And I also remember that our father particularly often taught politics. And in, I think it was 1927, when Calvin Coolidge declared he would not run again, I vividly remember that our father came home and discussed the third term tradition throughout the whole lunch hour. I suppose it was that sort of thing that inevitably made both my brother and me interested in politics and interested in reading and in doing well in school. My brother is actually a political scientist too. In fact, he was chairman of the department at Georgetown at the same time that I was chairman here at this department.
You said that when you said your father died when you were...
My father died when I was a senior in high school, which was 1930, and economically could have hardly been a much worse time. So the result was that I went to business school, and then...
You said your brother...
My brother went to LSU. An aunt and uncle put him through school there, so he went right straight through for all three degrees. I detoured by doing a business school and then working first for a law firm in Lancaster and then working for the state of Wisconsin for 10 years. And
Did you expect to go back to college then when you were working?
Well, that, you know, what does one expect? In a sense, I suppose this was always in the back of my mind. I always felt that somehow I hadn't had what I wanted, that I really wanted to go to college, and that opportunity hadn't arisen. I had done a few credits, and I'd taken courses from time to time. Actually, in the 10 years that I was in Madison before I went to college, one of the problems with the extension courses and other courses available at the university at that time was that it was really impractical to put together courses that would lead you to complete freshman or sophomore work so that one could then see an end to going through. Instead of that, of course, what I did was to work the 10 years and decide that I was at a blank as far as a changing career or an further career, and therefore I resigned from the state service and came to the university in the June of 1947. At that point I had 12 credits that were applicable.
You said you'd been active in the League of Women Voters.
Yes, I'd been active in the League of Women Voters, and that, of course, was a very nice opportunity both to give me opportunities to be involved in issues and politics of a nonpartisan sort, but which could be, of course, very important in issue-oriented matters. And it also was an opportunity to meet individuals, individual women, especially Elizabeth Brandeis, who was here at the university and who thereafter was helpful to me on more than one occasion in enabling me to go ahead into while I was here and was doing my undergraduate and master's degree work.
Mm-hmm. So it was logical that you'd come to the UW since you were here.
Yes, there wasn't any question at the beginning there as to where I would go. I was here, economically and every other way, there was no reason not to go to the university in Madison, and that's what I did.
And you said it was the age problem.
Oh, the age problem was not very significant in 47 because there were so many returning veterans, and so that all the time that I was doing my undergraduate and graduate work through 53, there were always others, especially men, of course, who were roughly in my age bracket. And perhaps this wouldn't have been a problem or a concern to me anyway, since I was obviously pretty certain of what I wanted to do, but in any event, the fact that there were others who were within at least 5 years of my age made this issue a non-problem. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as faculty relations were concerned, there Bill Young, who was in the political science department there, actually had just come back to the political science department here, was my advisor and was most helpful to me all the way through in encouragement and in suggestions and so forth. And I remember, for example, that at one point he told me, now if there's any time you want to have an exception to a rule, ask for it. University rules are made for the norm, but you're exactly the kind of person for whom exceptions can well be in order, so don't ever hesitate to ask for an exception.
Oh, that's nice, isn't it?
And then, is the Aniva Baldwin, I think we mentioned that. Then another person who was helpful besides Bill and other faculty members in the department, others were very helpful too, but and Elizabeth Brandeis, was Aniva Baldwin, who was at that time Aniva Meyer in the LNS Dean's office, and she repeatedly was valuable to me. I especially remember the time when I was taking more credits in the summer session than were ever normally allowed. And she gave me a special telephone number so that if anybody tried to stop me in the process of registration because what I was doing was so out of order, that they could call and everything could be straightened out. As it happened, nobody did try to stop me.
So you finished up here and got your MA?
Yes, I finished up here so that I got my bachelor's degree. I didn't technically get it to January 50, but in the fall of 49, I had senior grad status and had been awarded a teaching assistantship by the department. So I was a TA in 49-50, and in those days it only took a full year, two semesters, and then you had a master's degree thesis to do. So I did the thesis in the summer and completed all my work for the master's degree before leaving for Minnesota in the fall. But technically my master's degree was in January 51.
Yeah, why did you go to Minnesota?
Well, when I decided to apply for graduate, and of course it really was a foregone conclusion almost from the time I started back to school, I applied for graduate work at Harvard, Yale, Chicago, Berkeley, and Minnesota, as I recall. And I did get accepted and did get a fellowship offer from all of those institutions. I guess actually the Berkeley one was a TA, but the fellowships in those years were rather small. I remember, for instance, that the fellowship, which was supposed to be the best one at Yale, was something like $400, and the Chicago one, which also was supposed to be the Great Chicago Fellowship. It was a so-called Walgreen Fellowship, and was only something like $500. And in all of those cases, you also had to pay the high tuition of a private institution. And although I had had encouragement to go to a private institution to get the experience of that after a public institution, it seemed to me that it was simply too expensive for me to take on one of those institutions. So I agreed to go to Minnesota, where I had a teaching assistantship. Afterwards, after I'd accepted in Minnesota, I did get the National Phi Kappa Phi Fellowship, which would have made at least the first year probably feasible at any one of the other institutions. But I've never been sorry that I went to Minnesota. I doubt that my career was in any way hampered as a result of going there instead of going to one of the prestigious private schools. In the line of that,
the material from here to approximately line 570 has been copied onto tape 2, side 1. It can be ignored here, and please therefore go on to line 570. On the cassette copy, it will be approximately a third further on this tape that you will turn to for the conclusion of this part of the interview.
Her job is her job. That the job itself, I mean, just how well she did as a person, I wouldn't want to try to evaluate. But that the that there was some almost necessity establishing that kind of position and putting some pressure on departments to act in this regard, I think, was there.
She's talked a good deal about the change in the university's personnel policy generally. Apparently there was none in effect until the early 70s. That is, it wasn't possible to find records in which one knew who, what people were being paid, when they'd been hired, what, when they were promoted, that sort of thing. This is both academic faculty specialists.
Well, now, forgetting the academic staff, and I don't totally know the situation on the academic staff side. On the faculty side, that's not true. You could always find it. Now, that you didn't, that, I mean, after all, a list went up every single year to the regents listing all the faculty and their salaries and the salary recommendations. This list went up every single year, going back for 50 years. I think it was true that one of the things that happened, the university grew very, very fast between the early 60s and the following 10 years.
Yes.
It just grew very fast. And I am sure that many kinds of data and information that one might quite reasonably want to know about faculty salaries, how long people had been here, and a number of things like that were available, but they just weren't brought together anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure that was true. And I'm sure that, in fact, I think we still lack some records here that we ought to have. I know that sometimes information about faculty meetings go out to people who aren't faculty members.
Mm-hmm.
And we still don't. One has always scared me to death is that if we ever got collective bargaining, we'd really have problems identifying who really are the faculty members who could vote on something like that. Now, that scared me for 10 years, and I've talked about this to people.
Mm-hmm.
But I know it still continues. I know that in the medical school that they have people who are in, I don't know exactly the technical thing, but they're not really faculty members, but they have a relationship with the medical school, and that these people get notices of our faculty meetings when they really haven't any reason to get them. It isn't that I give a darn whether they get get the notices. Mm-hmm. It just illustrates the issue. Mm-hmm. And we still have some problems along that line. So that for her to say there weren't good records, I'm sure she was right. There weren't good records. Mm-hmm. There still are some incomplete records. But partly, I think one does have to associate this with the enormous growth that took place in the tenure. I'm sure our department, as many other departments, I'm sure our department doubled in that length of time. And this was happening all over the university. Well, it's almost a miracle if you keep, you know, if you really develop a record system and change it fast enough to take care of this difference.
I guess part of the affirmative action program entailed the approval of even faculty appointments in the chancellor's office. That is, Serena Ponham, as head of the personnel, was approving them, and this was in terms of whether there had been adequate search for women appointees. And I imagine one of the complaints was that this was taking some power out of the faculty.
Yes. Now, I don't know how many times there was any veto on that. I don't know of any absolute veto on this, on an appointment as a result of that kind of review. I'm sure that a department who, if any department got a veto at that point, I'm sure they would have been pretty furious about it, because this does take it away both from the department and from the dean, now of course the chancellor always technically has the last word before it goes to the regents, No, Ed Young, as I think I know him, I doubt that he very often exercised an actual veto. There might have been occasions when there was a discussion with a department chairman, but I doubt that the actual veto really occurred. I could be wrong. I don't know. I don't know at all. I know Ed Young, and he finds actual vetoes on many administrative matters difficult. And in a case such as this, where you were actually dealing with a departmental and a dean's decision, I would think that would have been peculiarly difficult for him to carry through. On the other hand, that there was a kind of threat of this, that there might have been some carrying on of discussions. Well, that's part of the kind of pressure you tend to do when you're trying to achieve university-wide a policy that goes against the practice of some departments. And so, although I doubt the actual veto, there may have been some kind of a threat of this, a review, and so forth. I don't know.
Okay. The secretary of the faculty was Charles Loomer Bill Loomer was in the office at the time. I guess their function was somewhat taken over by the chancellor's office. Were you in on? Did you have any?
No, we didn't have much. You see, Bill Loomer had he just been chairman of the university committee, or had been chairman 3 years before, or something? That again goes back to the whole issue of how your records are kept.
Yes.
And I believe that the records did need improving. And as I say, I'm not even sure that today we still got them in fully good shape. And if I were to comment on Bill, he always has had a tendency to take life as easy as he can. And I'm not saying this critically, but Bill's not the kind to enter into a big fight or to be greatly innovative in this kind of thing. I suspect he took on the secretaryship of the faculty with the assumption that he could just carry on from Alden White. And he was not about to make big changes. And of course, as you need new information for different purposes than you've used it in the past, then you begin to need information that hadn't existed. Mm-hmm. And so there was going to be some conflict, I assume, there. this is one of the things I try to teach people in administration, that what kinds of statistics you have may determine a policy, and if you want a different policy, you may have to make a big thing out of getting different statistics. And this is, we often overlook this, but just the kind of data that's brought together. At one point, we had almost no Bureau of the Census data on county government. We had it on cities, occasionally on villages and states, but very little on counties. Well, the County Governments Association really lobbied to get special information in the census data on counties. Mm-hmm. And this put the county in a totally different light and with a totally different kind of opportunity for influence than it had before. The same thing holds true here. And as long as the university was smaller, there were always people who knew these things. I mean, they knew how many women, they knew whether there were salary problems, they knew this. They may or may not have paid much attention to it, but they likely knew it. But when you had this tremendous increase in the faculty in the 60s and into the 70s, nobody really knew. And in fact, the Chicago people gave me the Walgreen Fellowship, offered me the Walgreen Fellowship, which is the fellowship for a graduate student. And later, one of the men at Chicago said, in effect, well, we never have that turned down. Mm-hmm. Well, I couldn't afford that. And the Yale people, I know, used my case as a base for raising their fellowships in the future, that they would turn down, the fact that I'd turned them down was something that they used. So anyway, the only one I could afford, I felt, because I felt I had to have a reasonable amount of income, was the teaching assistantship at Minnesota. And then after I had accepted at Minnesota, I then did get the National Phi Kappa Phi Award, which would have made it possible for me to go on to one of the other places. But I never regretted it. I was encouraged by the faculty here to go to a private institution for the contrast. Mm-hmm. But they understood the financial limitations, and it's possible that if I had waited around a bit, that Harvard might have been able to have done something additional, because I know there were some negotiations going on with Harvard. But I got uneasy and accepted. As I say, I've never been really sorry. I think it worked out well for me.
You didn't have to TA there, did you?
As a matter of fact, I didn't TA there, because then I got the Phi Kappa Phi, and I used mm-hmm. the Phi Kappa Phi at Minnesota, and I never did TA there. I had a project assistantship 1 year, the second year I was there, and then I had a very good research grant my third year my dissertation, and Walter Heller had been very influential in getting me the grant that year. So I really couldn't complain of mistreatment at any point along the line. I really got opportunities and offers and that were surely very much acceptable.
Just to follow this along, you must have had offers since you got here to go elsewhere.
Yes, never anything that I followed through very far, but I certainly had, questions, the sort of thing you get when people are trying to see whether you will or will not move. Mm-hmm. I investigated a couple of deanships and a few other things like that, yes.
I didn't
find that the opportunity was going to be that. Partly, I think you partly make a decision in terms of the kind of base you build up in an institution by staying. If you do unusually well in research and scholarship, and this becomes the thing alone that you want to do, then moving around often works out to your benefit. if you're more institution-oriented, and I guess I've always been more institution-oriented, then staying throughout one's career has its own advantages, and I think I've had them here.
What makes you institution-oriented?
That's a question I don't really know how to answer. I think it's true. I know that not only am I institution oriented in terms of the university here, and I suppose because I've lived in Wisconsin the much larger part of my life, I've always had a certain kind of feeling of loyalty and enthusiasm and interest in the state as a whole. But there is another aspect here which I'm conscious of in talking with individuals who are interested in going. I'm thinking as much of students in administration as I am anything else at this point, and listening to other people. I always felt that if you worked somewhere, you were expected and should be loyal to where you worked, and if you really didn't like it, you should get out. And I notice many people who work for state agencies or federal agencies or for private industry or whatever seem to feel perfectly free to be extraordinarily critical about their colleagues, about the agency or the company that they're working for. To me, if I felt that way, I wouldn't stay. That I suppose part of my satisfaction is in working where I not only think I'm doing satisfactorily, but where I have respect for the institution. But that doesn't tell you why I have it, and I really can't tell you why I feel that way. All I know is I do. Maybe it's very old-fashioned, I don't know.
Well, it's interesting you're saying that, because I was just reading the tape index of I had an interview with Jim Scott before he left. And that was one of the points he made about what was happening in the 60s, was the decline in people who were concerned about the institution and the growth of professionalism. People were loyal to the profession rather than.
I can't
he felt
help
that
it.
This was a pity. I don't know how you.
I think I agree with him. I'm curious as to what then he went to Yale, but anyway. Of course, his background was Yale, and you could say that.
I believe he left because his wife couldn't get a job here.
Oh, yeah. that certainly could be another issue that you get into.
Yeah.
No, I agree with him, and I think it has increased in the 60s and 70s. Partly, I suppose, many of the disciplines were maturing, which in itself tended to increase professionalism. Then I think also and that in a curious way, the enormous availability of grants, substantial grants, whether to travel or to do research or whatever one was going to do with it, made competitive professionalism almost a necessity if you were going to do certain things. And in some fields, and of course Jim was in a field where you had to get abroad, and I think that availability of grant funds certainly increased the professionalism. That's got pluses and minuses. It certainly isn't either one way or another, but I think it contributed to it. And the identification with the profession more than with the institution.
They do go hand in hand also.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, as you say, that's just the period when grants were available.
Yes.
Who invited you back here? Do you know how that happened?
Well, I think if you mean in terms of individuals, I suspect Bill Young had as much to do with it as anybody. But the department was small at that time, and I knew several of the people here in the department quite well, Jim McCamey and Llewellyn von Kooken and others whom I'd worked with as a student. And of course, I knew slightly some of the people in Extension that I worked with for those two or three years. And I suppose this combination was what was important. I do remember one thing very much, that at one point Bill Young talked to me about what I wanted to do, and I talked about going to and the idea of enjoying a small institution. And Bill said, you can't afford to go to a small institution. And Bill always has had a tendency to have to be very sure about things, state them very surely. Anyway, his point was that he felt that a woman would have more difficulty in those early 50 years in a small institution than a large institution. I don't know whether that was true or not. All I know is I didn't have any particular problem here as a woman. Mm.
Was it difficult to come back having been a student, and were you the only woman in the department?
I was the only woman in the department, and to some extent, yes. I think it's always difficult to come back to a department that you were a student in. It takes a little while to be accepted as a full colleague, and I don't think that this is intentional on anybody's part. I just think it's just inevitable. No matter how much they like you, no matter how much it was their decision to ask you back, partly their fault and partly your fault, because mm-hmm. you too feel, well, you know, you still have a certain faculty student relationship that you are conscious of. And I recall a colleague of mine who'd been a graduate student, who wasn't at Minnesota with me, and he went to Yale and then to Johns Hopkins, and he was invited to Minnesota before he went to Johns Hopkins the second year he was out. And he said to me, I don't want to go back to Minnesota yet. He said, he had actually done his undergraduate work at Yale. He said, I'd be too much a student. It would take me a while. And I think that there is an element there of going back to your institution and having to, for yourself as much as for anybody else, establishing the fact that you really are a faculty member mm. now and not a student. Yes, I think that's true. As far as being a woman was concerned, I must say that I never felt any real problem about that here. I would not argue that every department was identical on that. I would say that as far as I was concerned, I didn't feel it. I used to say the one place that I felt I suffered prejudice was that in the early years especially, it seemed to me I was put on far more university committees than was the norm, as if every committee they decided they needed a woman on it. So they'd look around and so I'd end up on a committee. So my proportion of committees in the first 10 years I was here at Wisconsin, I would bet, was higher than for many, many men, or for the average man here. Now, I don't say that's all bad. That has its pluses. And it's really been sort of a joke that it seemed to me that was the place I noticed prejudice. I just had an extra amount of assignments this way. But, of course, having been named chairman, that threw me into a very special relationship. And I was the only woman in the department at that time. I was the first time that the department had a woman chairman. And in fact, a man professor I'd known at Minnesota who had gotten his doctorate at Wisconsin many, many years ago wrote me a very cute note at Christmas time and said, how horrible. A woman chairman for political science, can you imagine such a thing? It could only happen at Wisconsin. And so this was the sort of situation I found. Now, everybody has a different experience. I don't know what you want me to go on with.
Your salary, was that...
I don't think that I was discriminated against in salary, no. Certainly when I was chairman, I was very much recognized by the dean there, as other chairmen had been recognized. The salaries in the 50s, of course, were not very high. Certainly by any modern standards, they were horribly low. But I don't think that mine was in any easily perceivable fashion different than what the men were getting at that point. And there were two or three times in my career where I got very special recognition while I was chairman, in part of the time that when I was director, and certainly in the years when I was on the university committee and the merger committee. Those were times when and those were mostly decisions of deans. Because as you probably know, the chairman, when you're chairman and when you're director, or when these are things that get done through the dean's office rather than by your colleagues. But when my salary was subject to collegial judgment, I didn't feel I was being discriminated against. And certainly I wasn't discriminated against by deans. And there were several different deans over that period, because while I was chairman, Ed Young was dean for 2 years, and then Leon Epstein was dean, and then it would partly have been Steve Kleene, and I guess it would have been Steve Kleene through the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And actually, when I was named to the Merger Implementation Study Committee, the dean and the chancellor got in touch with me and told me, now we know that this is very important, it's going to be very time consuming, and they made a big thing of reducing my teaching load at that point. Mm-hmm. So I don't think I was treated differently than a man. How can you ever be sure? But as far as I'm concerned, I don't think I was.
Well, now you know, because you can see salaries, but
yeah,
wasn't,
well, I could see salaries then,
but you didn't look.
Oh, sure I could. In fact, I did. I mean, after all, we've always seen salaries here. We've always been, anybody could always see what a faculty member's salary is here. This is one of the things some people don't know, but the budgets always laid them out, and you could always go look at a budget in the Legislative Reference Library or anywhere else. I always knew what salaries were. But maybe one thing, I dealt with salaries when I was in the state government, and there was some point at which everybody got so upset about so many things that I sort of inured myself to be taking every little difference in every dollar that seriously. But I'm one of the highest paid people in the department today, and I have been for 10 years, or close to 10 years, so, well, I suppose 10 years. So I really don't feel that I have any reason to complain.
Yes, it sounds pretty good. Well, to go on with the affirmative action, when did you start, or did you start getting acquainted with the other women on campus? Did you at any time feel any special affinity to them as women?
I guess the answer has to be no. I did not work with the women's groups here, partly because I never felt that.
Wait, when you say women's groups, you must be referring to around 1969
and 70.
Yes. Because there wasn't anything.
That's right, no.
But what I meant was before that.
Oh, before that?
Just getting to know people, was there any kind of, for instance, did you go to the university club? I know for quite a while it wasn't possible for women to...
That preceded me, really. Discrimination at the university club really was in the 20s and 30s. Somebody like Helen White could have told you those stories. But that was, most of that kind of discrimination in terms of where you could sit, etc., disappeared with World War II. Mm. for instance, in the Union, the pre-World War II situation had been the Rathskeller was exclusively for men. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those things make more sense than we tend to think they do now, because there was also some very special places where women could be in, and there were places where everybody was together. But that's one of the things that disappeared with World War II, partly because either there were not many men around, or the men were mostly the men in service who were permitted to use the Union. And one way or another, the whole issue of the Rathskeller as exclusively men's place disappeared. And I, as far as I know, this disappeared in the university club. Now, I guess that reading room, the reading room, I guess that did remain almost a man's preserve till I don't know when, because I didn't pay any attention to the university club. The university club, like some other things, were sort of departmental matters, well, they weren't, but they worked out that way.
Yes, well, I know what you mean.
The political science department, almost nobody belonged to the university club. We all tended to go over to the Union to Trip Commons for lunch, and for years, until some of the outbreak of the late 60s, there was practically a table for political scientists, mm-hmm. and sometimes after an election or around election time, all kinds of other people would join us. And I remember, I've forgotten which election it was, we ended up with a table that had been added to until it was practically the whole east end of Trip Commons.
You're talking about presidential elections.
Yes, it was a presidential election. So that the department didn't go to the university club, and therefore I didn't go to the university club. Now, it was no decision, it just was that way. And so until the late 60s, it would have been true that the department as a whole, so I didn't pay attention to the university club. Yeah. But somewhere, even before that, of course, Helen White had been elected president, so had Martha Peterson, and so had other women, so that the university club had clearly ceased to be a men's only club. Somewhere in those years, I think I've seen the dates on that, but I've forgotten what those dates. But they mostly preceded me, so that when I came here in 54, those were not major issues around here. And some of the stories of substantial discrimination, such as the length of time that Helen White took to get tenure, although that wasn't, you always had to put that in the context, because getting tenure was a much longer process generally in the 20s and 30s than it became in the 50s and 60s. The norm in the 20s and 30s was 6-7 years, or sometimes even more, and it's coming to some degree, that's becoming more common again today, when certainly by the middle 50s and 60s into much of the 70s, 3-4 years became much more the norm. So that these are things that are not necessarily related to women. Whom did I know among the, well, of course, Elizabeth Brandeis would have been the woman I knew best in among faculty women. But I did get acquainted with Helen White and Ruth Wallerstein and a few other women. They were in the social sciences, of course. Elizabeth Brandeis was the only woman there. Helen Clark was in social work. There really weren't many other women in the social sciences, and the only one I can just offhand think of is Elizabeth Brandeis. So that the women were more in the humanities, and especially the English department, where the most scholarly faculty members were mostly all women. And then there were a few in some of the sciences. I didn't actually know Elizabeth McCoy until probably the middle 60s or later, and she was certainly a person that one had enormous respect and regard for.
Did you, was it a matter of interest to you whether the political science department hired another woman, or didn't you think in those terms?
I didn't think in those terms. And of course, you know, these things, of course, have a sort of circular problem. If a profession or area does not appear to be very open, because there aren't many women in it, then of course there aren't many women who try to get, and you can use the same thing for minority groups, there aren't many women who tend to get doctorates and seek a profession. Mm-hmm. So the number of really quality women that we looked at in the 50s and early part of the 60s. Now we did hire one very distinguished woman who's become very distinguished from Berkeley in the 60s while I was chairman. And there was no question about her quality. She actually went back to Berkeley, but that was not because we didn't try to keep her. And there was certainly no indication on the part of anybody in the department that they were opposed or, in fact, it was unanimous we'd like to have kept her, so it had nothing to do with sex. And as more and more women did become, did get degrees and look good, we of course now have, I think there are 6 women in the department, so there's been a very major increase. We had, now while I was here in the early, there was another woman here for a period, but she then went to Milwaukee, Carol Edelman. But other than that, we just really didn't look at women. I could add that if you look at the political science profession nationally, there were some fairly distinguished women in the 20s and 30s, most of whom were in some of the important women's colleges of the East. And there were some important women. Louise Overacre is one that I think of just offhand, but there were others, Bell Zeller and a few others who'd done some special work. And there was no, they were important. But when I was getting my doctorate at Minnesota, there were a couple of women besides myself, I think, in those whole 3 years. There might have been more than that, but I don't think so. So that the proportion of PhDs that were going to women in the 50s were very low.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a period when people, when the younger women were tending to have make family extremely important, and there weren't too many women in the older group who came back and did as I did.
All right, well then let's go to, I think the, in 1970, HEW came to campus and was concerned about how affirmative action was going on here, and in response to that, a number of women, Kay Clarenbach apparently got together some women over a couple of lunches to discuss it. Were you in on that, invited to it? Or?
I don't recall whether I was invited to the original. Kay, of course, has always been an extension and has not been a part of the Madison faculty. I think there was something a little earlier than the 70s. In fact, I think that HEW visit was in part brought about by some of the women who were anxious to have an investigation. I did not participate in that, I guess because I did feel that there were some hidden agendas there that I wasn't interested in participating in. And in saying that, I don't say that there was no basis for complaint. Certainly on the university committee, we had one or two cases to deal with where at least one college, I don't know if I'll name it, but one college in the university here had really treated, or some of the faculty, and had treated one woman in just a disgraceful fashion. It was one of those situations where she'd been kept on for 20 years and suddenly got told she couldn't have tenure. And it was just ridiculous. And there was no question that the dean It was in the medical school. There's no question. The dean of the medical school, the chancellor, the vice chancellor, and everybody on the university committee felt this was outrageous, and it was taken care of. And I'm sure that there were some other instances of that kind of treatment. As I say, it varied. I think the problem varied by departments, and that I was fortunate to be in a department where it wasn't a major issue. And because I felt there were some hidden agenda items in it, one of the problems, and I don't know any solution to this, but it's one that has troubled me and obviously troubles other people quite differently. And it's not the only issue here by any means, but sometimes a person was appointed here, and it could be either the husband or wife, and then but it tended probably more to be the husband, and then the wife seemed to feel a obligation on the part of the university to hire her. And I must say that I always thought that was unfair. I thought it was unfair to single women as well as to others. That if I, you know, that I didn't think, I thought I had to compete with all the candidates. And when a husband and wife were here, and the wife felt, and I felt that she had a right to something, obviously she didn't expect to compete with the nationwide. And this issue came up again and again. Also, given the kind of self-rule that departments have, I would have to admit, and I've always said it, I would not be comfortable with a husband and wife in my department. Now, some departments apparently can manage this reasonably well. I think it's easier to do it if both husband and wife have established themselves as scholars. Mm-hmm. Then I think the problem tends to evaporate. But if you take a husband and wife right out of graduate school, well, one may turn out to be very good and the other one may not turn out to be very good. What do you do?
You're talking about within a department. Are there cases of people within a department who are
husband and wife? Oh yes. Yes.
Yes, I can see that would be a very...
And in the Wisconsin situation where salaries are determined within the department, where there are all kinds of issues that can come up, this can become a problem. And I've just never been very enthusiastic about this, and this puts me down by some of the women's groups, because I don't share that kind of a view. I'm absolutely opposed to discrimination when it's really discrimination. Mm-hmm. I just want to be sure we're not dealing with something besides discrimination here. Mm-hmm. And obviously the word discrimination itself has both a positive and negative meaning. And so if what you're doing is discriminating as to what is good and what is not good here, then that's one thing. But you can use the term very now. I recall very vividly an individual we had here, a student, a woman who was extremely good. And her husband was actually in another department, but he never rated as high as she did. And they both got jobs at Michigan State. And when tenure came up, he didn't get tenure, and she did. Well, fortunately, in this case, he did find a position in another institution within reasonable distance of East Lansing, and I guess everything's gone relatively smoothly for them. Mm-hmm. My own advice to students when I was chairman, and we had couples finishing their PhD here, my own advice was, look at large cities. And whoever gets the job first, okay, then the other one should find it. And where you've got several institutions in the same city, you can probably both get jobs in political science departments. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the woman was brighter than the man, and sometimes it was the reverse. And so it was my view that that was the best advice I could give them. Go look for a job in a big city. Choose institutions that are in large cities where whoever gets the position first, the other one can probably find something within the area. Now, this is the kind of advice that I think is good. On the other hand, in my defense, I will say I think of one woman, and I will not give a name here, who used to tell our senior women, that they should go learn typing, and that way they could always find a job. And I remember saying specifically in one of those meetings, look, I tell my senior women, if you know how to type, don't ever admit it. Mm. And this woman subsequently became very major in the women's movement. I think my advice, which long preceded hers, was much more reasonable and rational.
Who was that?
I don't really like it. It was Emily Chervnik.
Oh, I don't remember.
And she was in advising here.
Yeah.
And she was very important in the women's movement and became much more militant than I ever did.
Uh-huh.
And yet I felt that basically I'd been giving him better women's advice than she'd been giving.
Well, maybe she needed converting more than you did. So, well, were you aware of this? You say hidden agenda. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think sometimes they had political ends in mind that were not necessarily part of it. I think they were trying to look after women who weren't necessarily that outstanding. And they were claiming they were being discriminated against. And sometimes they were trying to find jobs for people just because their husbands were here.
Yeah.
I mean, these were some of the hidden agendas I saw there.
Mm-hmm.
And they tended to be very willing to be anti-administration in a way. Again, sense of loyalty and institutional identification would have been somewhat on the other side.
Yeah.
Now, as I say, I knew there were problems, and while and I'm sure that in Serena's position, she identified problems that needed attention, because departments and colleges varied. And some, well, you know, the history department had a bad reputation for a long time.
Yes.
The history department, in fact, had a bad reputation on Jews and Catholics at one point.
Yes.
So the department had a bad reputation on a number of areas.
Mm.
Well, they got over it. And but some areas, they clearly did need some pressure. The English department, once Helen White and Ruth Wallerstein and Madeline Doran, et cetera, really hit their stride, which was in the 30s and 40s, obviously the English department was not a place where a woman was going to get a hard time if she, you know, if she could do it, she could do it. And they were certainly going to recognize her. And this simply varied.
Were there women, I mean, for instance, women in the language department, Barbara Fowler, Charlotte Brancard, think of people like that who were on the faculty by that time, weren't they?
They came in, I think, in the 60s. I don't think they were there before the 60s.
All right. I just wondered, because they weren't part of the group you're talking about, although they joined it for a while. I know Barbara Fowler did.
Well, you see, Barbara Fowler, of course, is another case where her husband was here and she wanted a position here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have absolutely no personal knowledge either of how she stands scholarly or anything. I don't even know how she got the position.
Mm-hmm.
But she obviously wanted a position in Wisconsin because her husband was here.
Yes.
And I can only make that statement. I know nothing more about it. And I don't I didn't know the women in the languages. I did know some of the men who, for varieties of reasons, I knew, but I didn't know I did know Barbara Fowler. because I'd known her husband for probably the 10 years before they were married. And of course they were married and then they had a family and then she came into the university.
Yeah.
So she could not have come before the middle 60s into the faculty, and I may have even been a little later than that.
She didn't get on tenure until sometime in the early 70s. So
yes, well, she didn't come in until late, I think. Do you want to try to open that?
I was thinking that. I don't know whether you're hot, but
yeah. But I'm afraid the fan would just make trouble, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. Be too noisy.
Yeah.
Anyway, one can live with heat.
You're going to have to...
Oh, all right.
Just... But, it's all right.
Well, of course, what I'm curious about is Serena Pondrum was... chosen to be to go to administration, and how you felt about that, and whether you thought about it,
at the point about the time that she was appointed, I think it became almost necessary in almost any institution to have an affirmative action officer. Mm-hmm. If you weren't, you really were not in the stream of things.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly she was involved in this one case in the medical school that I was speaking of, and nobody that had anything to do with that case but what it would have said, the woman had been badly treated.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time it was in such a mess, it didn't matter whether she was any good or not. You can't do some things.
Yeah,
that. And I don't even know the quality of this woman. All I knew was the story. Well, I'm sure there were some others like that that were important and needed somebody, and maybe if quite possibly it was critical to have somebody who would ride herd on it.
Mm-hmm.
Although in this instance there was no division that I know of between anybody in authority over what ought to be done.
Yeah.
It was the immediate department that was, and the immediate chairman of that department that was causing the problem, and once you got out of that situation, everybody else was in agreement.
That must be the case she mentioned, where the chairman said she's only got 6 publications, and that Sarita said, she said, yes, on the first page she only has 6, but on the next 2 pages she has 30.
No, I doubt that's the same case.
Oh.
I doubt that that's the same case. I'm not sure which one she's talking about, but I think